Maine's emergence from World War II into the new millennium. Maine moved on from the Second World War, as did the rest of the country, but the state has also had its own history in the 50 years that followed. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on Maine Calling, we'll explore the events, the people, and the politics that helped to shape where we are now. This show is part of our ongoing coverage of topics related to Maine's bicentennial, and is the fifth and final in our series on the history of Maine. The years from World War II through 9/11 led to lasting changes in our economy and in our culture. We'll learn about some of the key moments and about some of the important Mainers who truly made history. The story of Maine from World War II to 9/11, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio Studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Looking back at Maine history coming out of World War II, we find a state that evolved at its own pace. So what changed between the end of the war and the turn of the millennium and the attacks of 9/11? That's our topic today, and this the last in our series on the history of the state as part of our coverage of topics marking Maine's bicentennial. Joining me today, Libby Bischoff. She's professor of history at the University of Southern Maine and executive director of the Osher Map Library. Earl Shuttleworth, longtime historian for the state of Maine, and Captain Jonathan Bratton, command historian for the Maine National Guard. As always, we want to hear from you. What stories have you heard about living and working in Maine in the 50s or later? You can reach us. We want to hear from you. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. And before we kick off here, a programming note. Maine Calling will be airing at a new, earlier time starting on Monday. You can hear us at 11 o'clock in the morning. We'll bring you the same interesting conversations, and our evening rebroadcast will remain at 7 p.m. Tune in to our new 11 a.m. start time beginning next week. So this is a part of history that some of us can actually remember parts of, including myself. And I want to ask the panel first, each of you, to kind of, as you look over the 200 years of Maine history, give us a synopsis of what history will say or has said about this particular, 50-year stretch after World War II. Earl, I'll start with you.
Yes, I'm going to take a little different tact and really focus on the fact that in this 50-year period, there were significant advances in Maine's cultural institutions. In particular, right after the war, the Farnsworth Museum opened in Rockland. This was followed by the formation of the Colby College Museum in 1959, which of course has expanded now into a very large facility. And then in 1983, the Portland Museum of Art added the Payson Wing. These were all significant advances in bringing to the public, both Maine residents and the many people who visit us, the wonderful cultural heritage that the state has. And at the same time, this was also a period in which government, both at the state and federal level, became involved in history and culture, the formation of the Arts Commission, Historic Preservation, the museum, the cultural building opening in 1971. These are all things that have enriched the lives of Maine people in that 50-year period.
And so that's your cultural lens. Earl, Libby, what do you see?
So I think as a historian, it's always difficult to study the periods closest to the present, especially with on a public radio show when many listeners are thinking about this as the course of their lives and not necessarily the past, very much the present for them. So for me, this era is a complicated one because you see Maine making a lot of transitions, one to a more modern economy, certainly after World War II, and you see the waning of some historic natural resource industries and a growing dependence on paper mills. The textile mills are really challenged in this era. The fisheries are challenged as well. Politically, it's also a complex era because as we move into the 1950s, Maine had very much been a strong Republican hold, you know, nationally and throughout the counties and cities and towns. And we see that challenged by Muskie's election to governor in the 50s and beyond. And I think for me, you know, working at a public university and thinking about education, K through 12 and beyond, is that this was also the period where the University of Maine system was formed in 1968. It's also a period where you see a lot of school district consolidation as the state has to really work on funding the K through 12 in this period. And then finally, I would mention, and we'll get much more in depth on a lot of these topics, this is an incredibly important period for both environmental action and civil rights, really defining the way in which we live in Maine and the way that rivers and pollution are regulated and the expansion of voting rights and people's continual fight for equality.
Yeah. Jonathan?
Yeah, I'm definitely, I sound like an echo here, but a time of massive transition, especially militarily when you look at, the Korean War being the first conflict where, the populace was not called upon to make the stupendous sacrifices that they had in the previous two world wars, which will begin a trend going forward through Vietnam and then all the way up to 9/11. And so you begin to see some of a disconnect between the traditional society and its own military. And it's something that we see in this period in the National Guard transitioning away from combat roots, its traditional infantry roots, and moving into things like engineering, aviation, and other types of units that were not so much geared for these large conflicts, but geared more towards these smaller conflicts and, you know, what some might call nation building. And so what we see is a lot of these larger national trends reflected back here in Maine and making those changes in people's lives.
You mentioned 9/11. I guess we wanted to also talk a little bit about why this period, for our purposes, ends with 9/11. And is that because it changed our lives so much that it really deserves the mark of a new era? Is it because it was at the turn of the millennium? Earl, I'll go to you and ask, why is 9/11 the other bookend?
Well, I think 9/11 was such a dramatic event in recent American history. In a sense, it was almost like another Pearl Harbor in which we were actually attacked on our own shores, so to speak. And I think what we often create our benchmarks in history through these conflicts and through these really major overarching events that happened in our history. And so I think the World War II to 9/11 as that we're discussing today, I think it is a very distinct piece of history. Certainly on the larger scale in the national and international scene, America begins to play a very different role after 9/11 than it has previously.
So for the purposes of what will be a somewhat chronological discussion here, we'll follow themes as well and the arc of change within those themes. But it might be good to, rather than start at the end of World War II, to back up a little bit back into wartime. And Libby, I guess I'll ask you to take us back to World War II and talk a little bit about what was going on here on the home front and how, you know, sort of what was happening in Maine, including, I guess, the Liberty ships. We can talk about that. But take us back to set us up here for this conversation.
Certainly. I think, you know, thinking socially and culturally and certainly economically as Maine is preparing to enter this war along with the nation, you see the defense industry building becoming very important in Maine, particularly with the building of the Liberty ships. And so you really see the greater Portland area completely transforming in a variety of ways that are very much with us during this era. You have the Liberty ship yards in South Portland and Portland. You have ships being built and turned around in unbelievable time. You also have a lot of people going off to war. And I think this is an incredibly important time also for women. You have hundreds of female laborers working at these shipyards, building the ships, and you have a great need and expansion for housing. And so you see housing developments in greater Portland being built to accommodate the war work. And also you have to remember that the World War II production in many areas of the country brought it out of the Great Depression. This does not become wholly true in Maine, but it does drastically spur the economy. And I think in terms of thinking of Maine in World War II and not just and certainly honoring the sacrifices of those who fought, there's instances in Maine history where, like, many people don't know that we had a German prisoner of war camp in a variety of Maine locations during World War II, most notably up in Houlton from 1944 to 1946. And so Maine is very involved in this international conflict, both here within the state and by those who are from the state fighting abroad, which certainly Jonathan would know more about.
Yeah. Jonathan, do you want to continue on?
Yeah, absolutely. Massive, really just this incredible event. You have in early 1941, even before war is declared, you have all 4,000 of the troops in the Maine National Guard mobilized, some for the protecting the coast at the fortifications that dot Portland Harbor that, we might drive past every day. That was the front lines for the Atlantic War. Beginning in 1940 and then through 1941, you had both regular troops and National Guard troops manning those coastal fortifications. And then as war came on, you have Maine National Guard soldiers serving all over the globe, fighting through the Southern Pacific and some very, very brutal combat, being involved in some engagements that, we look at them and it's a small island that you don't recognize and no one knows the name of, but, you talk to some families, I was doing a presentation, Mechanic Falls, and, you talk to some families and they know the name of Munda in New Georgia because it was something that, their family members just said they wouldn't talk about because it was too horrible. And then you had, troops fighting through Europe. We even sent a truck company to Iceland for 2 years. So just all over the world. And then it's something to note that Portland is the closest deep water port to Europe, and so that became the home of the North Atlantic destroyer fleet. You had a submarine station and a training base in Portland. It became this. Was almost awash in this military life for these 4 years, and then just sort of faded away, and leaving with it all these people who now are experiencing people from all across the country who are experiencing Maine for the first time and thinking about maybe moving here. Libby mentioned industry as well, and it's just a very dynamic time to be living in Maine and to be a service member from Maine.
So, according to my figures, nearly 80,000 Mainers served in World War II. Is anyone?
Yes, you've got for combat service. You're looking at over 80,000 Mainers serving during those 4 years in all branches and all across the world. And it's also important to remember just diverging a little bit from the sort of war front, but back on the home front. There were, as shown by the great Maine Historical Society presentation going on right now, there were a lot of African American troops who were sent up to Maine. some as they were military police battalions. Some were doing just basic labor. Some were on guard duty, and they were, as is often the case with the struggle for civil rights within the military. We like to say, We're very proud of the fact that we led the charge to desegregate society. But it was still in the 1940s. You still had segregation of units, and a lot of the treatment of those African American soldiers was not equitable with the treatment of white soldiers who were also serving stateside in Maine, you know, guarding various locations on the coast and everything like that. So it's a continuing battle. One thing that's very interesting when we talk about World War II era on the home front is that Maine was authorized a state guard because all of the National Guard was called up. The state guard, since it was a state force, was not segregated. So there are actually photos of African-American troops serving in white state guard units. And it would actually be, you know, just a few years later in 1954, that Maine would, as a state, commission the first woman to be an officer under the auspices of the Maine National Guard, just a state rank, not yet a federal rank. So you can see the different pulls and pushes between national and state.
Yeah. Interesting. Earl, we need to take a quick break, and then we'll come back. We'll take this right back up again, all right? There's a lot to cover here. We will take a quick break. When we come back, we want your comments and questions as well. The number is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with Anti-CMEX smart pest control technology, modernpest.com. The University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom, uma.edu. And Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial, deadriver.com.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll hear from voters in some of the swing states that may well decide the 2020 election.
There's so many people that are supporting Trump that you wouldn't know about. But I think a lot of people just stay low and they don't want to fight.
I'll talk with our political reporters about what the election looks like on the ground next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And that's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 and Monday evening at 10 here on Maine Public Radio. Late this summer, we were notified that a few national programs in our schedule were being discontinued, including Live From Here, Only a Game, and the weekday 11 a.m. second hour of On Point. Therefore, starting this weekend, we've made some adjustments to the Maine Public Radio schedule to accommodate these cancellations, adjust the schedule slightly, and bring new programs to the airwaves, including As It Happens, Freakonomics, and Snap Judgment. For more information and to see the schedule, please visit mainepublic.org and click on the radio dropdown. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the history of Maine from the aftermath of World War II through 9/11. My guests, Captain Jonathan Bratton, Maine National Guard's command historian, Libby Bischoff, professor of Maine history at the University of Southern Maine, and Earl Shuttleworth, Maine State historian. As always, we want to hear from you. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Earl, I promise to come back to you in a moment, but we are going to speak now with Cameron Held, who's on the line with us, I think. Cameron, are you there?
Yes. Hi.
Yes. Hi. Welcome to the program. Tell us about, you have a new book connected to the bicentennial. Tell us the name and what it's about.
Yeah. So it's called Maine the Way. It's a special edition of a quarterly publication that we put together, and we worked with the state of Maine to do a special bicentennial edition. So it's a 200-page print publication. Long-form stories, and it covers the history of Maine and then a bunch of stories about the present, kind of looking forward to the future.
So you had the same challenge, I guess, which is covering a pretty broad expanse of time. How did you go at that?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. We kind of didn't want to come across as a textbook. You know, we're a very visual publication, so we decided to come at it as doing 20 little vignettes. So one from each decade of the past 200 years. And those varied from pieces about Neil Dow, Portland's mayor who was into the prohibition, to stories about the fish concert up in Aroostook County. So just fun little one-off pieces that I think give a sense of the history of Maine, but don't tell every detail.
Sure. How can people find it?
It's available online at our website, mainetheway.co, but it's also available at most booksellers around the state.
Okay. Cameron Hill, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Maine the Way. And Cameron Held worked with the Maine Office of Tourism on this new bicentennial book. All right, back to our discussion. Earl, you wanted to make a point about World War II.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple things, Keith. One is that we mustn't forget the important contribution that the Bath Ironworks made. They launched numerous destroyers during the war. In fact, sometimes, every few days, there would be a destroyer being launched into the Kennebec River. So they played an important role. And also just a footnote to the discussion about the armed services. 1948 is the year in which President Harry Truman actually desegregates the armed forces. And a year before that, he and Margaret Chase Smith worked to actually allow women to have full status in the military. She was the sponsor of a bill for that.
And let's do a little politics now. This seems to be a good time. And you mentioned at the top in your synopsis that this post-war period is notable for, I guess it was Libby who mentioned this, is notable for this this transition away from Maine's identity as kind of a pretty solid ground for Republicans into a true two-party system. And Libby, I guess I can start with you. What sparks this change? Is it immigrants? What are the factors that moves Maine that moves the Democratic Party in Maine back into a front position?
I think, as with any political shift, there's never just one. There's never just one cause. But certainly what helped Muskie, and he was the one, and kind of a young son of an immigrant coming from Runford, pull this large upset in the 50s, is really the economic downturn that Maine was experiencing. I think that economic downturn and rural poverty and it continued suffering a lot among a lot of Maine's populations as textile mills were closing in some areas and being challenged is people being open to new solutions in a variety of ways, right, and new ideas, and that Maine, for many people, seemed both stuck and stagnant economically in a time period where much of the rest of the nation was experiencing a post-World War II economic boom. It took Maine a little longer to get into that. So for me, I think it's certainly partially the challenges of the economy that allow people to start looking around a bit more.
I would just add to that, because I can remember this from my own personal experience, that also Edmund Muskie was a youthful, charismatic figure. And I know my parents were moderate Republicans living in Portland. The buzz all around the state was that here is this new young leader, and we really should get behind him and follow his new direction. And so my parents and a lot of their moderate Republican friends supported him and then continued to support him throughout his career.
He was a Polish-American, but also Catholic. Was that significant at the time?
Yes, definitely. But I think that the personality and the message that he had for leadership in Maine made people want to follow him.
We mentioned Margaret Chase Smith also in some earlier comments as a kind of a person who represents quite a few firsts. The first woman to serve in both houses of Congress, among others. But she came to national politics in kind of an unusual way, right? She was not on this political arc toward a certain office, but she was married to a congressman who then died, and there was a special election. Can either of any of you sort of pick up the story and I guess give a sense of how Margaret Chase Smith is this critically interesting, important figure in Maine history?
Certainly. To just go back to her emergence into politics, she had been very active in the 1920s and 30s in women's organizations in Maine, like the Business Professional Women's Organization. And then she married Clyde Smith from Skowhegan. She was from Skowhegan also. And he was a congressman in the 30s. And when he passed away, just before he passed away, he kind of signaled to the party leaders that he wanted his wife to take his place, and then she ran in a special election and won, and then in 1948, in a very challenging primary against several major Republican figures, she won out and then went on to be elected to the Senate. So she was the first woman to serve in both the House and the Senate from 1948 until 1973, when she stepped down from the Senate. She became one of the most influential, one of the most powerful, one of the most followed figures in the U.S. Senate. Of course, she came to great prominence in 1950. She'd only been in the Senate for 2 years when she took the floor and gave her conscious speech, her statement of conscience against Joseph McCarthy, and ultimately, of course, it helped to lead to McCarthy's political demise.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was looking over the Declaration of Conscience, I guess as it was called, that she read, and there is one quote where she says, quote, I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear. And so she was making a statement not only about the times, but about her party and what she envisioned as what its values should be. I don't have a question there. I'm just noting it and wonder if you have any reactions.
Well, I think that really represents the creed, the political philosophy that Margaret Chase Smith employed during her entire career. She was known and respected for her independence and for her clear thinking. And in many ways, I think she reflected the values of Maine people in her time. And those values were then conveyed onto the national and international scene.
And I think it's one of the most, it remains a really popularly taught speech in 20th century, not just Maine history, but U.S. history. And I would urge listeners who had not read it before, it's not a particularly long speech. I mean, she really made her points very clearly, but she wished to really rise above the sensationalism. And it's striking to read something, from 70 years ago that still reads as incredibly modern. So I definitely urge people to read her Declaration of Conscience if they haven't.
So this whole era will shift now to the state's economy. Libby, you had mentioned that this was a time of real change in the manufacturing structure sector of the state and a bunch of and many other sectors. Also, labor becomes a big factor here. Tell us a little bit about or give us your sense of what happens after World War II and what puts into the wheels of change here, these major changes in what's driving the economy.
Sure. There's a lot of changes that Maine has to reckon with in this era that nationally and internationally have to be reckoned with as well. I mean, the golden age of the Maine economy is really the 19th century natural resource industries, looking at granite, looking at lumber, certainly looking at fishing, ice. But as you get challenges post-Civil War, when the United States is not so much north-south, but after the war is really east-west, you have a lot of competition in markets. And after World War II, certainly with the increased production of highways, increasing transportation, you had a lot of federal investments in irrigation in the Southwest and in the West. There's a lot of challenges. So Maine farms are challenged, certainly because there is new mechanization. There are new markets of growers elsewhere in the United States. I think it's significant that from 1940 to 1975, Maine actually went from 39,000 farms to 6,800, which interesting today is that the last survey, they do farm surveys every 5 years, but Maine is at 7,600. So we actually have more farms today than we did in the 1970s. You see a booming paper industry certainly throughout much of this time period, but that's challenged with global competition. And the textile industry becomes incredibly challenged, not just with global competition, but with local competition, as you see states within the South paying much less to their workers, but not having to deal with the same sorts of labor laws as elsewhere. And so that all becomes really significant. So Maine has stability in defense manufacturing. They have stability in the paper industry throughout a lot of the 20th century. But the fisheries are also really challenged. There are many national and international rulings during this time period about who can fish what waters, particularly between Maine and Canada. There's growing conservation efforts. And so you see businesses and individuals really having to continually adapt. And rural poverty is significant in this era, incredibly significant. And some of that is alleviated by infrastructure and changes in transportation, probably none more so than the building of something that we take for granted, maybe traveling every day on the Maine Turnpike, which doesn't go all the way up. You know, it only gets Kittery to Portland to 1947, goes to Augusta in 55, Bangor in 1960, and then Houlton in 1967. So these networks are become really important.
Yeah, and that changed also, I'm guessing, the role that rail played, or it was a challenge for rail. Sort of, I guess it changed everything.
Yes. Well, of course, right around 1960, the Maine Central Railroad discontinues passenger service. I think a lot of this had to do with the growth of the automobile after World War II, and as Libby has already indicated, the extensive improvements in highway construction, not only the Maine Turnpike, but also the, you know, the beginnings of the I-95 system as well. And as a result, people are using their automobiles, and also there's bus service, so the passenger service disappears.
All right. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your some of your questions and comments, if you have them. The number, again, is 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com. Modern Pest Services, now featuring the Anti-Cemex Smart Pest Control System for your home. Learn more at modernpest.com. And the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom. UMA.edu.
Inventor Freeland Oscar Stanley passed away on October 2, 1940. Born in Kingfield in 1849, he, along with his twin brother Francis, designed a successful auto steam engine and created the Stanley Steamer automobile. The cars had gained such a reputation for quality and reliability that they went into mass production with the Locomobile Company of Massachusetts in 1898. During 1898 and 1899, they produced and sold over 200 cars, more than any other U.S. maker. In 1906, the Stanley Steamer broke the world speed record with a speed of 127.66 miles per hour.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine!
Racism is trauma. But it's hard to talk about the impact of racism on mental health.
We have created a society where vulnerability is a weakness. So is it unique for Indigenous people not to want to disclose a vulnerability? No, because we've done that as a society to all of us.
In a New England News Collaborative special with America Amplified, how communities work through the stressors of racism. Please join us.
And that's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today's topic, examining how Maine changed from World War II through 9/11. Joining me, state historian Earl Shuttleworth, USM history professor Libby Bischoff, and Maine National Guard historian Captain Jonathan Bratton. Join the conversation. The number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're mentioning coming out of World War II. It would not be, obviously, the last war that Maine and the nation lived through. Korea, Vietnam, the first Gulf War. In fact, Jonathan Bratton, even prior to Vietnam, the Maine National Guard was active overseas in Berlin at one point in the 1960s. I guess they were being deployed at that point.
Sure. So the long arm of foreign policy definitely reached into Maine beginning in the 1960s. You know, as the Cold War is just this very tenuous thing at the time, and with the Berlin Crisis in 1961, things threatening to go hot. That impacts a community of 500 soldiers centered around Lewiston, South Portland, and areas in between. You know, the 2nd Battalion of the 20th Armor Regiment was called up for active service. This is the first large, real active call-up since Korea. And while these troops are not going to go overseas to Berlin, the idea was all these National Guard units from across the country would be called up for federal service in order as a show of force, for 1 year of federal service, show of force, and then allow active duty units to deploy over to Germany, where the possible showdown could be. And so, thankfully, it did not turn into a hot war. But that is, they didn't know that at the time. And these 500 service members going off for training, and eventually they're able to return home after about a year. But it was a very uncertain time for those soldiers and their family members and for everyone else in Maine.
Yeah.
It becomes much more real.
Sure. Sorry, your phone is checking out now and then, so be mindful of that. We may need to see if we can reconnect. But we'll keep you on for now. Earl,
sure.
In my notes, it mentions that you had personal memories of going through this era in the 60s, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam era as a student at Colby.
Yes, that's correct. I attended Colby from 1966 to 1970. It was a very turbulent period on American campuses, as well as politically in general, particularly in the middle of that period, the 1968 election, where Lyndon Johnson stepped down and Hubert Humphrey and Edmund Muskie ran on the Democratic ticket against Richard Nixon, and of course Nixon won. My memories are from the very first moment almost that I got on the Colby campus in September of 1966. There were silent protests every Saturday at the flagpole. There were also during those 4 years much more visible protest marches. This was against the war. And then toward the end of my being at Colby, the spring of 1970 was also when the Kent State situation happened with the incursion of America into Laos and Cambodia and all the upheaval that caused. And at the very same time that was happening and affecting the tone on campuses, at Colby that spring, there were about 20 students, black students at Colby, and they had become increasingly concerned about the fact that the college was not offering a broader curriculum for them, as well as more black professors. And they actually, for a few days, took over the college chapel and held it. And there were large protests at Colby around that whole civil rights issue. So I do have very direct personal memories of those 4 years and the politics and the themes that were around both the war and the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement.
And Libby, you mentioned earlier that this was also a time of change on the environmental front. Rachel Carson publishes Silent Spring in 1962, and this would, you know, later, this is new consciousness about this, but also movement by two prominent Maine politicians, Ed Muskie and George Mitchell, on clean air and water legislation.
Absolutely. And I don't think in this time period you can, I mean, it's easier now to kind of separate out the different threads, but certainly this increased environmental activism goes hand in hand with the civil rights movement. So as people are looking, you know, at this point from decades upon decades, particularly of water pollution in Maine, particularly the rivers from the textile mills, from the tanneries, from the paper mills, it was incredibly noticed. And there was a lot of grassroots civil action around it. Certainly Muskie picked it up at the federal level. But Maine is, you know, and he's carrying with him his experiences as governor, where there was a lot of advocacy around this. But I think it's no accident that at the same time, you see increasing push for environmental reform and people's quality of life in the natural world around them, and movements for land conservation and preservation and the founding of land for Maine's future, that at the same time you are seeing major civil rights legislations pass in Maine. You know, in the 60s and 70s, that period Earl's talking about, you see fair housing bills taking effect in Maine in 1966, the founding of the Maine Human Rights Commission in 1971. And so I think that activism is really important to think about at this watershed moment, much of it led by the NAACP in Portland and beyond. And so, you know, as people are thinking about the environment and the ways they want to live in it and with it, there are also increasing calls for equity.
And this, although it's much later in the 1990s that the nuclear power plant Maine Yankee is closed, there was a lot of opposition to Maine Yankee. Ultimately, its demise had to do with mechanical problems within the plant itself. But no doubt that part of that environmental movement was at play in terms of the opposition to that plant.
Absolutely. And you see, I mean, Maine leads the nation in a variety of environmental reforms in the 70s and 80s, some of which we still take for granted, like bottle and can redemption. I mean, Maine puts a pretty comprehensive law into effect in 1976. We get rid of billboards in the 70s and 80s, one of only four states that don't have them. And so I think that consciousness remains strong across the aisles throughout the state.
So much that we go ahead, Earl.
Oh, I would just add that when we're talking about the environmental movement, we must remember Rachel Carson, who was a part-time resident of Maine and who published Silent Spring in the early 1960s, which was to alert people about the effect of chemicals and other forces on the environment, so much so that I believe at one of his press conferences early in his administration, President Kennedy was asked whether he had read Silent Spring, and he said yes, he had, and that he was very affected by it. So she's of course a key player, and the Rachel Carson Wildlife Preserve down in the southern part of the state bears her name.
Earl, at the top, you mentioned in your synopsis of this era that your lens was through that of the emergence of artists and museums. So I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit more about that. Just for context, in 1945, it's fair to say no one had really, not many people had heard of Andrew Wyeth at that time, when the Farnsworth Museum in Rockland wasn't even actually built yet. But something starts there, doesn't it? There's a movement that starts in the artistic community.
Oh, very much so. And just to speak specifically about Andrew Wyeth, he's born in 1917. Early in his life, he comes to Maine with his family to spend summers with his father, N.C. Wyeth, the painter and illustrator in the Port Clyde area. And then in 1948, he paints Christina's World, which is, of course, now at the Modern Museum of Art. And this is a painting that really puts him on the map. He's already started his painting career before the war in his late teens and doing very well with it. But this is a painting that with such an epic main theme that really puts him on the artistic map. And then, of course, he continues to paint in Maine throughout his life into the early 21st century.
And then the Skowhegan School is founded in the mid-40s. And that attracts a list of artists that we would recognize from Louise Nevelson and Robert Indiana, Alex Katz.
And Ben Shahn as well was an instructor there. Yes, very, very important force. And then, of course, a little bit later, around 1960, of course, it started a little earlier, but it coalesces on Deer Isle, the Haystack School of Crafts, which is, again, a very important creative center on the Maine coast for budding artists. And really, the whole art scene in Maine so flourishes and so emerges in such a force in this period that we're interested in today.
We only have literally 2 minutes left, and we've done what we can here. It's a difficult assignment. And I don't know what extent historians also play the role of futurists. But if we look back over, you know, the last 50 years, is there anything that you see as historians going forward as themes to that you believe future historians will track for the coming 50 years in Maine?
I do, Keith. And I think that we have to remember that these issues, you know, of the past are still very much with us today. That really struck me in prepping for today's discussion. I mean, looking at something like the Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act that was signed under Carter in 1981, it's fresh in the Maine legislature now. We are still reckoning with issues of the sovereignty that Maine's native peoples should have. And so I think these themes, you know, you said at the top, why stop at 9/11? I think you're going to see a period in history marked from 9/11 to 2020 with the crises of the pandemic, the crises of racism still with us. I think this is 2020 is going to be as much of a watershed year, if not more, than 2001.
Yeah. Jonathan?
I think, I definitely agree that looking back is the way to where you you pave the path to the future, especially looking militarily. 9/11 was a benchmark, but that benchmark really big as our looking at our military with the National Guard becoming an operational force. And by that, I mean constant deployments, you know, every few years, something that we had never really seen. And that, you know, makes a huge impact on a state like Maine, leading the nation with the veterans per capita, and then what that means for society and the impacts there. And so I think that's something that is important to look at as we go into the next 50 years. You know, what is going to be the role of Maine's people and as a society in the military?
Mm-hmm. Earl, you have 30 seconds.
Well, just to say that I think that throughout this period that we've been exploring over these few months, the history of Maine, and particularly the history of its people, the character of its people, tells us that there is a really rock-bound strength to our people and to our state, and that we have adapted to the many challenges of the last two centuries, and we will continue to do so.
Thank you all so much for joining us today and for your past participation in this series of programs. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Keith.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Libby Bischoff. Libby Bischoff, a professor of history at the University of Southern Maine, executive director of the Osher Map Library. Captain Jonathan Bratton is command historian for the Maine National Guard, and Earl Shuttleworth, Maine's longtime state historian. A reminder, Maine Calling moves to a new time starting Monday. We'll air live from 11 a.m. to noon. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. Today's program will be rebroadcast at 7, and you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.